I'm so glad we had this time together, just to have a laugh or sing a song. Seems we just get started, and before you know it, comes the time we have to say so.
The Carol Burnett Show ran for 11 years from 1967 to 1978 and won 25 Emmy Awards. She borrows a line from the show's theme song for the title of her new memoir called This Time Together, Laughter and Reflection from Harmony Books. It's filled with wonderful anecdotes about her life in show business from her early days in New York to the present, and I'm very pleased to welcome Carol Burnett back to our show. Hi, Carol.
Hey, thank you, Leonard.
You were here some years back to talk about your memoir called One More Time, about your childhood. Does this book pick up where that one left off?
Well, not exactly. It came as a result of my doing a lot of questions and answers evenings on the road for the past 20-some-odd years. And I decided to go on the road and just do a conversation with Carol, with the audience, where they raise their hands and I never know what they're going to ask, which was an offshoot of my Q&A when I opened the show, our show on television.
You used to do it before you went on the air and tape it, and then
we would tape it
and that edit out the better ones.
Yeah, right. And so this time, I just decided I would go out on the road, and there was no editing. And so over the years, there had been questions that were the same. You know, where did you learn to do the Tarzan yell? How did you find Vicky? Is Tim Conway really that funny in real life? So what developed was I would develop stories about, true stories, about these people answering the questions. And then I decided to put it on paper.
Do you need a hook to write a book? You say that you began writing the first memoir as a letter to your three daughters.
That's exactly right, Leonard. That was my hook, what I call my Dumbo's feather. You know, Dumbo, in the original,
the Disney movie?
Disney movie, thought he couldn't fly unless he had that feather in his trunk. Well, my Dumbo's feather hook was that I was writing a letter to my three daughters to let them know how their mother turned out to be whatever. And this one, this hook, was talking about the Q&As that I do on the road and all of the questions, so many of the questions I get and so many of the answers that I would give.
Well, I wonder if I should even ask you how you developed the Tarzan yell.
Well, that was my, I had a beautiful cousin. We were the same age, Janice, and we would go see the movies. And this is way back, of course. Yeah, now I know some of your readers may remember Nelson and Jeanette.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
Nelson Eddy, Jeanette McDonald.
And Jeanette McDonald. And so we would see the movie, then we would go home and play out the movie. So she was always Jeanette.
Mm-hmm.
I had to be Nelson. So we would see Tarzan and Jane in the movies.
You were Johnny Weissmuller?
I was Johnny Weissmuller because Janice had to be Jane.
You grew up in Hollywood but decided to go to New York to begin your show business career. Don't most showbiz aspirants move in the other direction?
Well, they do if they look like Marilyn Monroe and or even Tony Curtis, and I didn't look like either one of them. But I love the idea of being in a Broadway show. And my goal, my dream, was to be Mary Martin or Ethel Merman or even in a chorus, so that I could be on a Broadway stage and be able to pay my room and board. And that was my goal.
And you got a mysterious benefactor lending you the money so you could come to New York.
Right. That's true.
If you hadn't had that, I'm sure you would have made it because you've got so much talent.
Eventually, I would have still, you know, it might have taken me a few years to get the money to pay for an airplane ticket because we were not very wealthy at all. We were on what they call relief, which is
welfare today.
Yeah.
Why did he decide to back you, do you think?
Well, I was at UCLA, and I was in a class called Opera Workshop / Musical Comedy. And we had this wonderful professor who was at head of the music department at UCLA, Dr. Jan Popper was his name. And they were going to, he and his wife were going to sail to Europe this one summer. And he was being given a bon voyage party, a very posh black tie affair in San Diego. And he asked all of us, there were only nine of us in the class, and we were doing scenes from musical comedies or opera. And he said, okay, kids, come on down and be the entertainment for our party, and I'll grade you that night. So I was real excited, and I went down, and I had a scene from Annie Get Your Gun that I did, which was only about 7-8 minutes long. And I remember they had a big hors d'oeuvre table, and I had this purse, and I went to the hors d'oeuvre table, and I was slipping the hors d'oeuvres into my purse to take home to my grandmother, right? You know, don't pass up any free food. So, and then I felt a tap on my shoulder, and I thought, oh, I'm busted. Oh, my God. So actually, I turned around, and there was this gentleman in black tie, and his wife was with him. And he said, hey, we really enjoyed you. You know, and I'm closing up my purse so he won't smell the hors d'oeuvres. And so he said, well, we really enjoyed it. What are your plans in life? And I told him, I said, I someday would love to go to New York. He said, well, why aren't you there now? I said, well, you know, I don't have the means. And he said, well, I'll lend you the money to go to New York. And I thought he'd knock back a few too many champagnes. And
were you worried there'd be strings attached?
Well, his wife said, no, he means it, he means it. And he said, yeah, come down to my office a week from tomorrow. He gave me his card. He said, and I will lend you the money to go to New York.
And when you got here, you lived at the rehearsal club. What kind
yes.
of place was that?
It was fabulous. It was, do you know this play, Stage Door?
Yeah.
Well, that's what it was.
Everybody helping everybody, although a few people stabbing each other in the back.
No, that never happened when I was there. That was only in the movie. And it was a boarding house for young ladies interested in the theater. And there were a lot of Rockettes that lived there. And I remember I first moved in to the transit room, they called it, and there were five of us in one room, five women, and one closet, and one bathroom. Mm-hmm. And it was only $18 a week, room and board, because it was sponsored by a lot of wealthy society ladies in New York. So, and no men were allowed past the parlor, and you had to prove that you were going on auditions and trying to get a job. You could still have a part-time job doing something else, and which I did. I was a hat check girl in a ladies' tea room, which it wasn't too bright because not too many ladies check their hats.
They all wore them, of
course. They wore them, of course. But at least it was around Christmas time, so they would check their packages and stuff, and I would get tips out of that.
One of the hardest things for an aspiring actor is to get an agent.
Yes.
Did you get one?
Well, what happened was you couldn't get an agent unless you were in something. And then you had to be in something to get an agent. So it was a catch-22.
Still is, I think.
Yeah. And I remember Pajama Game was the big show. And I was at the club one night. All my roommates were out on dates. And I remember a friend of mine in California, he was an extra in movies, saying that he had done a movie with Eddie Foy Jr., who was now one of the major players in the Pajama Game. And he said, oh, Eddie's a great guy. And I thought, well, I'm just going to try something. And I remember it was raining like cats and dogs. And I went down to the theater at around 10:45 to where Pajama Game was playing. And I looked like a poor man's Ann Baxter in All About Eve. It was raining. I was just standing by the stage door. And I opened the stage door, and there was the Pops, of course, was at the stage door, the man you always see in the movies. hey, kid, come in. You're ringing wet. What do you want? What do you want? I said, I'm here to see Eddie. He said, do you know Eddie? I said, I'm from California. And he said, okay. So I remember hearing this clap. It sounded like thunder, but it was the audience applauding at the end of Pajama Game. And then I saw the stars, John Raitt and Janice Page and Carol Haney and Eddie Foy Jr. running back and forth taking their bows. Finally, they were headed for their dressing rooms, and Pop said, hey, Eddie, this kid wants to see you. So Eddie Foy comes, yeah, kid, what is it? I said, well, a friend of mine, Jack Shea, who played a cop in a movie with you, well, he said that you were a really great guy, and I'm trying to get into show business, but I don't know how to get in show business because I go to an agent, and the agent says, let me know when you're in something, and if I'm like, how do I get anything? And so I have an agent. He said, okay. He said, do you sing? I said, well, yeah, I'm loud, but I don't read music. He said, do you dance? I said, I can jitterbug. He's looking at me. Now, he was a very off-the-wall performer. He never had any formal training or anything, Eddie Foy. He was just a natural vaudevillian. So here I'm telling him, he said, well, maybe I can get you an audition for the chorus or the dancing or the singing in our show here. I said, but I can't read music, and I'm really not a dancer. And he said, well, what are you talking about? I said, I think I'll have to have a featured role.
Oh, whoa.
Why he didn't laugh me right out of the backstage, I have no idea. That was the most stupid, naive, you know. But he kind of laughed. And he said, well, okay, here's my agent's name. Go see him. And the agent's name was Lester Schur. And I went and I took my scrapbook of rave reviews from UCLA. I thought that would impress him. And he said, well, let me know when you're in something. And I said, but same thing again. And he said, well, go put on your own show. And I said, well, okay, yeah. So I went back to the rehearsal club and I called all the girls together and I said, this agent said we should put on our own show. So we did. And we made up our own stuff and we had some talented piano players and some composers, and our scenic designer lived across the street, who made lights out of coffee cans. He was Ming Cho Lee, who later on won several Tonys for lighting Broadway shows, but he was right across the street and a buddy. And we put the show on, and we sent invitations and the matter of penny postcards out to every agent and producer and director in town and said, you're always asking us when we're in something. Now we're in something, so come see us. And they did.
And were you the only one who really wound up?
No, there were two others. Two others got agents. And so it was terrific because then I got summer stock. And
then you had a first major break on the Ed Sullivan Show. And when we come back, we'll talk about that and some other things. I'm talking with Carol Burnett, who has written a memoir called This Time Together, Laughter and Reflection. It is published by Harmony Books. Stay with us. So I mentioned that you had a big breakthrough. You came into public consciousness with a love song about an unlikely political figure. Maybe should we listen to it first?
Sure.
Here is young Carol Burnett.
I made a fool of myself over John Foster Dulles. Over John Foster Dulles. The first time I saw him, 'twas at the UN. Oh, I never had been one to swoon over men, but I swooned and the drums started pounding, and then I made a fool of myself over John Foster Dulles.
You know, your voice hasn't changed all that much. I'd recognize you anywhere.
Thank you.
But you had, did you write that? Did somebody write special material for you?
No, I had a very good friend who was one of the top special material writers I've ever, in fact, I still work with him and his wife, Ken Welch. Mm-hmm. And Kenny, when I was the hat check girl, I would take lessons from Ken. And we'd write material, and I would pay him in nickels and dimes and quarters from my tips. It was $10 an hour, and it was all I would just throw out the coins. And so I had a chance to work at the Blue Angel nightclub, and he said, you know, I have an idea. This was at the height of the Elvis Presley craze in 57. And he said,
John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State at the time.
John Foster Dulles, who was very aptly named, I think. Mm. You know, he was very dour. Anyway, wore the overcoat and the fedora and never smiled or anything. You know, everything was weighed heavily on his shoulders. And so Ken Welch said, why don't we write a song about a young girl who is crazy about John Foster Dulles the way young girls go crazy about Elvis? And I thought that was very funny. Hmm. So he wrote that song, and I did it as my opening number at the Blue Angel, and then Jack Parr called when he had his nighttime show, and I went on, I remember it was in August of 57 on a Tuesday night, and I did the number. Then I went back to the Blue Angel, and the phones were ringing off the hook because I was going for the midnight show, and there was a gentleman from Washington calling, who was Mr. David Waters, I think was his name. And he said, oh, well, I saw that, and Mr. Dulles missed it. Could you do it again on television this week? So Parr called me back. I went on Thursday night and did the song. Then on Sunday, Ed Sullivan had called, so I did the number three times in 1 week.
Did that lead directly to you getting your first starring theater role in Once Upon a Mattress?
Well, that didn't happen for another couple of years.
Oh, but were you doing mostly nightclub?
I was doing actually some television, and then I met Gary Moore, and he had a morning show, and he put new talent on Fridays. And Kenny Welch had written a lot of material for me, and so Gary was so sweet. He said, whenever you get some new stuff, give me a call, and I'll put you on Friday mornings. Then when he got his nighttime variety show, he asked me to be a regular performer.
And you were doing that at the same time that you were doing Broadway.
Yes, I...
you started off Broadway with Once Upon a Mattress.
I started off Broadway with Once Upon a Mattress in May of 59 and then went to Gary in the fall of 59. So I was doubling. I had two great jobs.
Now, Gary Moore, many people won't remember, but the guy with the buzz cut.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that you learned an awful lot during that show.
I certainly did. He was one of the kindest and smartest. And when he had his variety show, I mean, one of the junior writers was Neil Simon on his show. And he had his announcer, who was also a very good comedian, Durward Kirby on the show, mm-hmm. and Marion Lorne, who was hysterical. And so he asked me to be a regular, and then we would have, for instance, on Mondays, because we would be doing the show on Friday, we would have a table reading with him and, you know, the writers and the scripts and the guest stars. And if he was given a funny line, you know, in a sketch or something, and he didn't think it was quite right, he'd say, you know, Durward can say that line funnier than I can. Give it to Durward. Or give this to Marion, or give this to Carol. He was so
beyond generous.
But then if he said, oh, I can do this, he would do it. So it was an ensemble thing where he was the star, no question, but he didn't rule with an iron fist.
And I assume that is what inspired you to put together your own group of rep players and do something rather similar. I mean,
yeah.
Harvey Korman got a lot of the best lines, although I assume many of them were made up on the spot. You won your first Emmy during the Gary Moore show.
Uh-huh.
And then CBS offered you your own weekly show?
No. Actually, I had a contract with CBS that within the first 5 years of the contract, if I wanted to do an hour-long comedy variety show, they would have to put it on the air. 30 1 hour pay or play. And so I thought I'd never be a host of that. I couldn't do that. And then finally, the last year or the last week of that year came along, and my husband and I were kind of sitting on orange crates, and we were doing okay, but we said, you know, we better push that button and tell CBS we want to do those 30 shows. And I remember calling one of the CBS executives and saying, you know, hey, he says, Merry Christmas, what's going on? You know, and I said, well, you know, I want to do that, I want to push that button and do that 30 variety shows. And there was this long pause. And he said, what? I said, 30 variety shows that was in the cut. He said, oh, let me get back to you. So I know they got a lot of lawyers out of the Christmas parties that night. And I got a call from him the next day. And he said, oh, yeah. I said, well, Carol, you know, comedy variety, being a host, that's a man's game. That's Gleason. That's Sid Caesar. That's Dean Martin. You know, Dinah had a musical variety show, but there hasn't been a woman to host a comedy variety show. And I said, that's all I know. That's all I want to do. That's what I learned from Gary, to do different characters. And he said, well, we've got this great sitcom for you. I'd love you to read it. It's just great. It'd be perfect for you. Called Here's Agnes. And I thought, if the script is as bad as that title, let me out of here. And so I said, no, I really, and they had to put us on the air.
And then when you wanted to leap after 11 years, they wanted you to stay.
Yes, they wanted us to come
back.
Had
you just gotten too tired of doing it?
Well, I wasn't tired. Harvey left us in the 10th season to go do a show at ABC, and I don't blame him. And so we did an 11th year, and I had some wonderful guests, and we had some really good shows. But some of the sketches that were submitted, I said, didn't we do this in the 7th or 8th year? Or didn't we do something like this? And I thought, you know, before they go, get out of here, I thought I should leave before the host starts turning the lights on and off. And so I decided to call it quits.
I also assumed that losing Harvey Korman, who was so integral to it all, although you did have Tim Conway, Lyle Wagner, Vicki Lawrence.
I had Vicki still.
Your daughter, who turned out to be your mother.
Right.
I'm not even going to get into some of the famous sketches. We were going to talk about the Rat Butler and Starlet O'Hara sketch, which I think got the longest laugh in the history of TV.
Well, it was pretty long.
But you've also done other stuff. You've had specials, and you've done movies, and including a fair amount of drama. Some actors have told me that it's harder to do comedy than drama.
Well, it depends on how funny you are. Yeah, I think what's harder for me is doing movies, whether they're comedy or drama. I'm a show horse. I like when it's time to start, that we start, we do it, we finish, and we go out to dinner. Mm-hmm. That's what I like, as opposed to getting up at the crack of dawn and sitting around and getting made up and ready for a shot that maybe not be happening until after lunch. I kind of lose it.
But there you were, Pete and Tilly, the front page for seasons, two films for Robert Altman, A Wedding and H-E-A-L-T-H, and then there's Friendly Fire and Annie. So you've had a lot of TV still?
Yeah. Well, no, I haven't been doing that much. I did a
Law
& Order.
Well, you did Mad About You.
You
did Law & Order SVU, which I like to call SUV.
I do, too. I get mixed up.
We want everyone to know that Carol Burnett will be reading, talking, and signing books this Thursday at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store at Union Square. And then on Mother's Day, May 16th, she'll be appearing at the State Theater in New Brunswick, New Jersey at 3 o'clock. There are details on our show page at WNYC.org. Her book, This Time Together, Laughter and Reflection, published by Harmony. And I want to thank you so much for being with
Leonard,
us again. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Same here. Back at you.
Too bad we ran out of time. There's so much more to talk about.